This is Mike Richardson, interviewed by Chris Eldon Lee on the 1st of May 2012. Mike Richardson, Part 1.
Mike Richardson. Date of birth is 12/2/49. Born in Hanover in Germany, actually.
Oh, right. Why was that?
Well, because my father at that time was in the army. So, actually, you're born in a sort of enclave of Britain, which is the British Military Hospital in Hanover.
So he was there with just after the war with the...
Yeah, well, I mean, he was actually in the army all his working life, so... We were very rarely actually in the UK, so we sort of trundled around between Singapore and Malaya and Northern Ireland and Germany and then back to Germany and so on.
Did your mother have a professional? Was she a professional army wife?
No, she was a professional mother because she had six of them.
Oh, right.
Actually, we were a very ordered family, so it goes sort of girl, boy, girl, boy, girl, boy. And I was number two, but there was quite a lot of us.
Well, the next question is probably more complicated than I expected, which is about your education. Where were you and what sort of education did you have?
Well, because of the army upbringing, I think I'd been to about seven schools in so many years, or in fact less than that. So I got eventually packed off to a prep school, a choral prep school in Worcestershire, which doesn't exist now. And I was very fond of that part of the world. And then I went to a public school in Sussex, Ardingly, and from there went to Durham. I didn't really want to go to Durham at that time because I was grouse-beating just after school, which is a great way of getting fit. And I got two offers came in one day after the other from St Andrews and Durham, and I wasn't at home, but my father was, and he promptly rang up Durham and he sort of said, he'll be there in 3 weeks' time. So my idea of taking a gap year out was sacrificed.
What was your father's name?
George Richardson.
Was he that kind of man then, to make decisions for other people?
When he thought I was probably just going to gallivant around for a year, yes.
In your best interest.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I guess you were boarding at some of these schools, were you?
Yes, I mean, I boarded from the age of about eight at this prep school and then also at public school.
So a bunk in a bunkhouse in the Antarctic held no fears?
Not really. It's a sort of it's a bit of a sort of extension of this sort of Boy Scout sort of... existence in some ways. And of course, Bass at that time, holy male.
Yes. Where did the interest in biology spring from?
Oh, well, that's the funny thing was, I'd never actually had any doubt as to what I wanted to do from about the age of seven. So it was a sort of a bit of a sort of Gerald Durrell type existence as a kid. You know, I mean, I had so many animals. I mean, it was almost positively embarrassing, particularly if you're at boarding school. So I used to...
You didn't take them with you.
Yeah. I used to go backwards and forwards between what was then... We were living in Harrogate. So I was going backwards and forwards between Harrogate and Sussex. And I used to cram all these animals into old army, ex-army ammunition boxes. One stage I had sort of like 40 hamsters and about six ferrets and a few other things. And I remember sitting on a train and we're just coming into Leeds, so we hadn't gone very far, when somebody said, oh, look, a ferret. And I thought, oh, my God. And the ferret was eating its way out of the box. And by the time I got to London, I'd strapped a huge, great, thick biology tome over the top of this box, and it was coming through the top of that as well. But no, I basically always wanted to do biology, and I had no, it wasn't a sort of question, really. I just instinctively fell into it.
So you did go to Durham?
I went to Durham to do zoology, yes.
Did that convince you that that was a career path you wanted to take?
Yes, but, initially, I mean, after three very enjoyable years at Durham, and I had two PhDs lined up, one on the population energetics of water voles in Sussex, and the other on the population dynamics of lesser white-toothed shrews in the Channel Islands. Sounds really fascinating, at Southampton. And then suddenly I thought, hang on, I've just done 3 years at university. I'm not sure I really want to do another three. And it was at that point, I think probably just wandering around the careers office, which I didn't visit very often, I suddenly came across the British Antarctic Survey as a potential job. And I applied to Bass, again, as a biologist, wanting to work on seals and seabirds. That was my whole... Really, actually, I wanted to work on mammals. It wasn't going to be quite like that.
Where did your interest in the Antarctic come from? What was your first memory of knowing a place called the Antarctic existed?
Well, it really wasn't. It wasn't interest in the Antarctic, and it wasn't actually really a great interest in bass. It was almost a sort of... It was an interest derived from the fact that I suddenly realised I didn't want another 3 years at university. I suddenly saw bass. I wanted to work on mammals. It was in the Antarctic. Actually, what really happened was, having been interviewed, and I thought for this job, possibly on seals, and if it wasn't seals, it was going to be seabirds, I turned up at Monk's Wood, which was then where the zoology section of Bass was based, just near Huntingdon. Because, of course, that time, Bass was spread all over the UK. And I'd only graduated, I think, on the sort of Friday or the Saturday, so this was the Monday morning. And the first two questions I got directed at me when I turned up was, how much marine biology do you know? To which I said, well, none really, because Durham doesn't have a marine lab. It was sort of snaffled years ago by when Newcastle University was hived off from Durham. So I don't know anything about marine biology. Oh, well, don't worry, you'll soon pick it up, they said. And the second question was, how good a swimmer are you? And I said, well, actually, not very good at all. Oh, don't worry about that. We'll send you on a diving course down at Swanwich and you'll soon pick that up as well. So, you know, the idea of working on seals and seabirds had gone out of the window, and I was suddenly, apparently, going to be press ganged into being a marine biologist.
Let's just go back to that interview in London. What do you recall of it?
Well, it was Bass, of course. The headquarters of Bass at that time were in this funny little terraced house. I don't know if it still exists, just round the back from Victoria Station. So I turned up there. I can't remember precisely who was on the interview board, but Bill Sloman was head of personnel. And the chairman of the board was actually Dick Laws, who was then the head of life sciences in Bass. And it was quite funny, really, because I was sort of sitting there and I wasn't really very well versed in interview techniques, one could say. And sufficiently not versed in interview techniques that the first question that the director of the chairman of the board directed to me, I looked at him blankly because I hadn't even heard it, because just over his shoulder on the windowsill, I was watching these sparrows mating, and I was actually much more engrossed in watching the sparrows mating than actually in the interview. I think this must have gone down quite well, actually, with Dick, who, of course, was quite a good field biologist. So somehow or other, I got the job. Of course, just after the interview, I then tottered off to Eland House, I think it was called, or Eland Place or something like that, which was the old ODA offices just by Victoria Station. And there was this really strange character. Well, I thought he was really rather humorous, actually. I think he was an ex-lieutenant colonel surgeon or something, very colonial almost, and very colonial-looking, who did the medical. And it was such a wonderful, bizarre medical. I'd never come across it. Anyway, I got the job. And
tell me about the medical.
Well, you know, he'd sort of stand across the other side of the room and bellow at me. This was to test whether I was deaf or not. And then he'd run through his set of questions, which included things like, you know, have you got this, have you got that, syphilis? And I said, no. He said, why not? And then he told me, basically, since I was asthmatic, he said, well, it's a big problem, really, because if you die, the ground's so hard they can't bury you. I said, well, I probably won't get asthma in the Antarctic anyway. So I seemed to get through both, I say, the interview and the medical, and got a job.
So what happened next? Because that's usually a hiatus in FID's careers, is they get offered the job and then there's some delay or there's some hassle about when to sail and what you have to do before you go. Were you trained?
Well, you see, in those days, I mean, everything's very pre-planned nowadays, so I suspect, well, I know, that particularly on the science side, science projects are planned and funded, etc., etc., years ahead, you know, probably a 5-year-plus horizon before things actually come to fruition. I think in those days, basically, it was sort of, a project was sort of almost, you know, you almost designed the project yourself. In fact, that's what happened. So I turned up, I say, at Monk's Wood, and having been told that I was now a marine biologist and I was going to be a diver, the next thing was, and by the way, the ship sails in whenever it was, October, November, you've got 3 months to plan this project. Well, decide what project you want to plan and get on with it.
So there was no bass input into what you're
saying? Well, not really. I mean, you know, you literally, there was no design. I mean, it was just basically you think of something to do and order all the equipment and get on a ship. Mm. And that's more or less how it worked. I mean, in retrospect, quite bizarre, really. But I think, to be very honest, you know, one was still almost in that phase of Antarctic presence, where the presence, you know, the issue of presence hadn't yet been taken over by the importance of science. So there was an importance of the UK being in Antarctica, and it was much more important to be just doing something useful, i.e. science, than sitting there playing tiddlywinks.
Were you aware of that, the political implications at the time?
Not really, no. No, not at all. It became very much more apparent, of course, about 17 years later when I actually returned to Antarctic, the Antarctic agenda, but this time from a political perspective.
I suppose also at that point, so little science had been done that there was quite a broad canvas to choose from, really.
Well, that's right. I mean, almost anything was useful. Because basically, yes. I mean, but I said that actually. I mean, on particularly on the biology side, I think bass was, you know, really quite cutting edge at that time. There was some really important work being done at Cygni, both on the terrestrial biology side and also the inshore marine side. There was some of the work that was done by Bass at that time, I think, was really groundbreaking.
What did you choose to do?
Well, since I didn't know anything about marine biology, it was quite a wide canvas. I opted to work on amphipods, small crustaceans. Actually, some of the things I set out to do in the Antarctic weren't going to work because my equipment, you know, went on the blink or whatever, and I actually did a much broader project than I had initially anticipated. So I was working on bivalves and all sorts of things, actually, benthic organisms generally.
And that involved you in the diving that you had to do, which you'd learnt in before you left. So what was the diving course like?
Oh, it was brilliant. Absolutely. It was really, really well designed for diving under ice in the Antarctic.
Really?
Yeah, really. So you went down to Swanage. There was Andy Clark and I. Andy was actually destined to go to South Georgia. In fact, he didn't end up diving because he had an ear complaint and couldn't dive. So we went to Swanage, and there was this diving school in Swanage. And at the end of the pier, they had a huge thing, like a big aquarium in full public gaze. And so you conducted half of your diving training in this aquarium on the end of a pier at Swanage. We did do a little bit of sort of disappearing down into the actual waters of the bay itself. But, I mean, as I say, it was really well-designed training for diving under ice at almost minus 2 centigrade in the Antarctic. And it was quite an amusing experience.
Are you being... Slightly cynical.
No, not at all. Not at all facetious or anything. But it was just this is my first. This is my first experience of diving. Was to be sent off to Swanage.
How do you learn to dive under ice on a pier in Swanage? I don't get it.
Well, you do. I mean, basically, once we got to base, I mean, there were a lot of people on Cygni who were diving, and so they don't necessarily throw you into the deep end. So initial dives in the sea at Cygni are obviously, you've got a lot of very experienced people as well you can go diving with.
Describe Cygni when you arrived in 71.
Yes, well...
What was the base like?
It was pitch dark. It was pitch dark, and we were on the Biscoe. And so we sort of hove into Bourge Bay, and it was absolute foul night. I mean, you know, we were dressed up as if, you know, it was so cold and depressing, blowing a gale. And this little light, well, you could see the light at the on the anemometer tower just at the end of, near the base. And then this little light sort of came bobbing towards us, which was, it was two guys. It was Eric Twelves and now, it was Peter Hardy, coming out to the Biscoe in what was the base's little 16-foot clinker dinghy. And, I mean, it was absolutely appalling sea conditions. They just tied up alongside, leapt on board, stayed to have a drink, grabbed the mail and disappeared again. That was my first impression of Signy. And, of course, the other thing that interested me was that we were dressed up to the hilt in sort of clothing, and these two guys came out on a foul night, not exactly half naked, but they weren't exactly dressed for the occasion, as I could see. But that was a degree of acclimation, I suppose, to Antarctic conditions.
And the hut itself, how was that?
Well, actually, if I went back a bit, I remember before we got to Signy, we dropped into KEP. And, of course, the Bass Base in South Georgia at that time was probably, I think it probably was, the biggest Bass Base. And I remember being incredibly disappointed when I walked in there because it was so palatial. Well, you know, it didn't strike me as being an Antarctic base. It was just luxurious. I mean, the bar and the dining room and the lounge and everything about it was just amazingly well appointed. And so actually, when I arrived at Signy, which is a bit more down to earth, very much more basic, I was actually much more delighted. It was what I expected. I didn't expect any frills.
So was it there's a large bunk room and others?
Well, Signy then consisted of, there was the old part of the base, the old wooden hut, which by now had become more or less the stores and engineering rooms, the jenny shed and so on. But the main part of the base on Signy at that time was this sort of thing that looked like a sort of pale yellow double-decker bus made out of fibreglass. It was fibreglass, prefabricated fibreglass panels that were stuck together, bolted together, and then sealed with mastic. It was fairly basic. Oh, the interesting thing about the mastic was that the sheath bills, the mutts, loved this stuff, and they would spend most of the summer running around on the roof pecking out the mastic so that we always had leaks through the roof. But I mean that the yellow double-decker bus, which of course is now gone since Bass rebuilt Signy, consisted of, you know, the bunk rooms, which were very basic and not heated, the lounge, kitchen and so on, and then the laboratories down below. So in fact, all the science laboratories and a wet room, a wet lab with full of aquaria, were down in the basement of the lowest sort of part of the building.
Was it not heated because there were no heaters, or because you were conserving energy?
The bunk rooms, I say, were fairly basic because they were just down one corridor on either side with some at the end, and they were just literally partitioned off with a curtain from the corridor. And certainly, I think they were largely unheated because we didn't have enough power. We were always getting sort of notes down from London demanding to know why we were getting through so much power. And I remember once sending them a telex, which was pages and pages and pages of all the power consumption of virtually every socket in the building. But certainly we didn't actually go so far as heating the bunk rooms. And I remember one day stuffing a thermometer down my sleeping bag, and it was about minus 22, and I didn't repeat that process again.
Minus 22 with you inside it?
No, well, that was before I got in it.
Oh, right. So you were heating the sleeping bag rather than the way around.
That's right.
Yeah. And what about the scientific facilities? Was it was the lab well equipped?
Well, I think it was. I mean, you know, I say the thing about Signy was, and I think it's a great shame that Bass ever abandoned that base effectively in the 90s.
Well, it went summer only, didn't it?
It went summer only, and that was a purely financial situation, and I by then was in the Foreign Office, and I couldn't disagree. It was, the funny thing was, I probably knew more about the science of Signy than those who were making the decisions. Mm. But from a political point of view, I couldn't disagree with the science. I could only push the political angle. But the thing about Signy was, as an Antarctic island, it had got everything. It had got fantastic terrestrial biology in terms of peat beds and moss beds. It had a whole range of lakes. I think I can't remember exactly how many is on Cygne, but it's about 13 or 16 lakes, many of them very, very different qualities. And it had fantastic opportunities for inshore marine biology. So, as well as, of course, a whole range of birds. I mean, there were, you know, vast array of birds breeding virtually almost on the back doorstep of the base. So seals, birds, marine, terrestrial, freshwater biology, Cygne had it all.
I know we're hopping about a bit, but when it came to that decision that Cygne should go summer only, did you try and oppose that?
We didn't want to, from a political point of view, in the Foreign Office, what Bass was suggesting at the time to save money was the closure completely of Cygne, and we would have gone down from, and of course Faraday, or Argentine Islands as it had been, was in the equation as well, because those two bases, Cygne and Faraday, were in many respects very similar in terms of complement and in terms of cost, but they were only costing Bass at that time about £700,000 a year to run in total. And we were arguing against decreasing the UK presence in the British Antarctic Survey from four bases down to two. Because basically, if you looked at our counterclaimants, and we're now into a much more political situation, the two counterclaimants to our bit of Antarctica, if you can put it that way, Chile and Argentina, have the most bases that you can, you know, of any of the Antarctic states, you know. And just from a pure presence point of view, we wanted to retain Cygne. Now, it got demoted effectively to a summer-only base, and that, in many respects, emasculated it, because by the time you move out all the physical infrastructure to support a diving program, for example, if you move all that sort of stuff out and move it down to Rothera, then effectively you almost do away with the sustainability of diving at Cygne. And, I mean, a lot of things just went, and I think it was a great shame.
I seem to remember the explanation. I was recording some interviews at the Cygne 60th reunion, would it be, in Cambridge, and the explanation seemed to be that with the advance of air travel, there was no real need for people to spend the winter at Cygne any longer.
Well, of course, you can't get to Cygne by air.
No, but they could fly to...
No, but the fact is, I mean, you can have this argument backwards and forwards. I believe that in terms of the range of... I haven't actually dived at Rothera, but I have dived down the peninsula. And the range of inshore marine habitats that I think exist at Rothera, certainly the range of terrestrial biology that you can do at Rothera, and there are no lakes. So, actually, Rothera is... It might be much more characteristic of continental Antarctica, but in terms of diversity of habitats and diversity of species, I would argue it was actually a very impoverished place compared with Cygne. But I say, at the end of the day, it was all about money. Suddenly, Bass had been brought up short because, obviously, during the 80s, post the Falklands conflict, something like about £90 million had been thrown at Bass by government. And that £90 million, of course, then spawned the James Clark Ross, the rebuild of Rothera, airstrip, buying a Dash 7, extending the Bass headquarters in Cambridge, all this sort of stuff. But, of course, the more and more complicated logistics you bring in, which then needs sustaining and managing, which, of course, is then a cost, something has to give if suddenly your budget starts flatlining or even goes down. So, you know, the more expensive toys you have, logistic equipment, that all needs to be then maintained and managed.
And therefore the more expendable places like Cygne become.
I think so, yeah. I mean, you know, obviously it's progress. I mean, running much more complicated ships. So if you go from, it's a very simple situation, if you go from the simplicity of something like the John Biscoe to then the complexity of the James Clark Ross, and this is just an example, a ship example, it's the same of running Cygne to running Rothera. I mean, these are much more expensive logistic operations.
Let's go back to your heyday then at Sydney, if we may. And tell me about the diving you did down there. First of all, you had to get used to the idea of diving under ice.
Yeah, well, Tommy, I mean, I was a lousy swimmer. I mean, I actually didn't like swimming. I mean, I remember at school, I used to have to go and swim at sort of 7:10 in the morning in an open pool, and it was freezing. So instinctively, I didn't really like it, but, I mean, that wasn't a great problem. There's a great difference between diving in the summer and diving in the winter. And actually, perhaps oddly, diving in the winter is a lot easier. So you're not boating and messing around in small, open dinghies. And the dinghies we were using then were small, and they were just little wooden clinker dinghies. They weren't sort of ribs or Zodiacs or something. But, of course, in winter, you can actually drive out to a diving site very rapidly, having pre-cut your holes, perhaps in the morning. We always used to dive after smoko. And there's a very, very good physiological reason for this, because diving in the middle of winter under ice is not exactly, you know, thermally the most comfortable thing to do. And it might sound a bit disgusting, but if you've just had a tea break, and about halfway through your dive, when it suddenly gets really cold, particularly if you turn upside down and have a pee, it actually warms the whole of the wetsuit up. And we were at one stage doing some physiological experiments for, now I can't remember the name of the medic. He wasn't actually at Sydney, he was in South Georgia. He never got to Sydney, but he was due to get to Sydney, but actually got waylaid and became the medic in South Georgia, Dave somebody or other. Anyway, we were doing this physiological stuff for the medic in South Georgia, which consisted of all sorts of things. Testing the temperature effects on physiology of divers, which involved sticking probes up your rear end, swallowing radio pills, and all sorts of other things, and then doing all these sort of either mental or physical tasks underwater, like screwing brass nuts and bolts together, or actually with a whole series of stupid questions like A precedes B, and you had to actually say whether they're right or wrong. And actually, what was amazing, that when you're sitting down there after half an hour at a relatively shallow depth, you realise just how befuddled you were becoming, which was never normally apparent to you, because we would be diving at far deeper than the sorts of depth ranges that these experiments were being done. Dave came to the conclusion that we actually should all be clinically dead because we were measuring body core temperature drops of something like 2 degrees centigrade. So, but actually what was interesting is of the 5 or 6 people who were doing his experiment, if you'd actually just all stood them in a line from sort of long and thin to short and tubby, you actually would have actually been able to draw his graphs for him straight away, because if you got a bit more blubber on you, you got less cold, and if you were long and thin, you got extremely cold.
Your diving facilities were pretty rudimentary. I mean, I think that you actually went to Palmer later on and saw what they had, what the Americans had.
Well, yeah, we were still diving in wetsuits, so it was all fairly sort of primitive. And basically, you know, you came in from a dive and leapt in a bath, and you know, that's what you did, just to warm up. And I went down, it was actually just after Dave Fletcher had come in from Halley to take over from me as base commander in what probably was about February 1973. And having shown Dave around the facilities at Sydney for about 2 or 3 days, I sort of said, well, bye. And Paul Skilling and I, Paul was the diver, professional diver on Sydney at that time, very young guy, actually. He was only 18 when he turned up on base. Paul and I disappeared on the Bransfield to go down the peninsula. I hadn't been down the peninsula. I'd basically only seen Sydney and South Georgia. And I thought this was a great opportunity. So we went down the peninsula to do a bit of diving. We dived at Argentine Islands. We dived in the Back Bay at Stonington, which was very interesting. Actually, it was a completely different sort of habitat and range of species than I'd ever seen at Sydney. I remember we collected loads and loads of scallops, quite difficult actually. The whole of the Back Bay was full of brash ice, which was great boulders of ice, actually. So actually even getting into the water was quite difficult. And there was a swell coming around the corner. But anyway, there's all these... The Latin name at that time, I think it's changed, was Adamusium. Smallish scallops. And remember, we were swimming around collecting these things, trying to shove them in a bucket, whilst all the same time they keep jumping out of the bucket. Anyway, we collected a couple of bucketfuls of these things, told somebody on the Bransfield as to what to do with them, like purge them first before you're going to eat them. But anyway, they didn't. And quite a lot of people got really quite ill with these scallops. But it was interesting diving down the peninsula. And when we arrived at Palma, I was amazed because Palma Station at that time was almost about the same complement as Signy. We used to play Palma actually at darts, so over the air. It was quite interesting. But Signy at that time was about 12 to 16 people. Palma Station was about the same. Well, you know, we had, say, four support staff, you know, diesel mechanic, radio operator, cook and diver. All the rest were either scientists or scientific technicians. When you get to Palma, it's a complete reversal. They had two scientists. Everybody else on base were support staff. And I went in the Jenny shed and I said to these three guys, what do you do? And they sort of looked at me and he said, well, him and me maintain these motors, you see. And I thought it was incredible. But their diving facilities were fantastic. You know, they got heated dry suits and diver-to-diver communications and diver-to-surface communications. I thought this was, you know, compared with BASS facilities at the time, we were certainly very rudimentary.
And you actually had to make, you were so rudimentary, you had to make your own wetsuit.
Yeah, well, Paul, the diver, really got into, Paul was obsessed with trying to actually have a wetsuit that was really a dry suit. So he used to experiment with wetsuits all the time, and he was forever making thicker and thicker wetsuits, which were designed to exclude water totally. Even, I think, if I remember, put a valve in the top of his head, which he reckoned would purge all the air out of his wetsuit. Yeah, we were, you know, the fact is it was very simple, and if things, you know, if suits got torn or something, it was actually very easy to repair them. And, I mean, on the whole, it's not exactly the most pleasant experience sometimes. It's quite cold. The interesting thing was from Dave's experiments, when you come out of a diving hole, you immediately start feeling warmer. You know, you finish the dive, you feel warmer, but actually what's really happening to your body temperature is it probably is at its lowest just as you're getting into the bath back on base, which is probably about 20 minutes later. So there's a sort of lag factor there, which is quite interesting.
Were there other dangers associated with diving through ice? Somebody got to find the hole again.
Well, we were roped up. There were a couple of occasions when... No, I used to dive at night, and I remember there was one occasion when... diving at night is actually quite interesting because it is almost as different as, say, going out into a tropical environment at night compared to the day. So if you went out at night, the air is full of whatever they might be, you know, moths or mosquitoes or whatever. If you dive at night, the whole water column is absolutely full of things, you know, annelid worms, amphipods. I mean, if you're diving in the day, the water column is normally completely free of animals. At night, it's like a soup of swimming animals. It's quite amazing. And, of course, it's a bit more scary. And I remember one day diving under ice at night, and you're just, you know, obviously you've just got a torch. We had got to the end. We'd got to the end of our ropes. And yet, just beyond where we were, there was some really, really interesting whole wall of anemones or something like that. I can't remember exactly what it was. But, well, we thought we can't just... Well, we wanted to go and look at them. We can't just sort of let the rope go, because obviously they'd pull it in. So we tied the ropes to a little rock pinnacle and then continued with our dive. By now, we weren't roped up. But, I mean, you know, that wasn't all that scary. There was a time when we got an instruction from London because they wanted to rebuild the slipway at Signy the following season. Could we go and survey the bottom of where the slipway was going to be very accurately. Well, the problem was that with sea ice in, there actually wasn't much space between the bottom of the sea ice and where the slip was going to be. It was literally, we were crawling around like as if we were caving, trying to actually survey the slope of the shoreline there. And I was a little bit worried because I came out of the diving hole and I was diving with Paul, and I pulled in his rope, and all that came up was the rope. And I waited about 3 minutes before I thought, I'd better get back in there and find out where he is, at which point he just popped up. It was all a big joke as far as he was concerned. But this guy was an amazingly powerful swimmer. I've never seen anybody who, for example, could drop his weights into, say, 30 or 40 feet of water under ice. And if you take your weight belt off under ice, you actually get pinioned up underneath the ice, like, you know, as if you're trapped. And yet he could then swim down with a very thick wetsuit on and retrieve his weight belt. The rest of us would all be just literally stuck there, like, you know, flattened silhouettes against the bottom of the ice.
Did he have any problems with leopard seals?
Yeah, they were... I mean, leopard seals, I remember... Owen Darling was on base when I first turned up, and Owen used to go down to Gourley every day in one of these little dinghies, 12-foot dinghy. And there was a leopard seal that particularly took an interest every day around the penguin colonies. And, of course, leps can stand, it's a big seal, particularly the females, they can stand out of the water really quite high, you know, 4 or 5 feet, they'll come out of the water. Which means if you're in a little 12-foot dinghy, they're actually looking down on you rather than anything else. And this animal basically got to the habit where it would actually grab hold of the gunwale of the boat and start shaking it. After that, Owen always used to carry a .45 Colt with him. And basically any leopard seal that wanted to do that was liable to get a hole through its head. I remember one day we were just about to go for a dive in the bay just off from the base. We were all kitted up. We were sitting there waiting to go diving. And then there was this lep in the bay, so being prudent, we decided not to dive. But Eric Twelves, the base commander, Eric was wonderfully bloodthirsty sort of character, really, in the nicest sort of way as a professional biologist. But Eric used to catch old notes, Notothenia, because he was working on them. He used to catch them in things like very similar to lobster pots, which he used to need to bait with meat or some kind. And so Eric was desperate for some fresh meat for his fish pots, and we needed to get rid of a seal in the bay at the time. So that poor old lep actually got a .303 bullet through it and disappeared. Eric immediately said to Pete Hardy and myself, well, can you go and get it? And I said, well, I think I'll wait a few minutes. I think I'll wait a few minutes because... I don't really want to go in there if it's, you know, if it's still around, which was just a wet as well, because about 3 minutes later it surfaced again, not looking too well, and it got another bullet in it, at which point Eric said, well, I'm sure you can go and get it now. And it was a bizarre sort of experience, because I remember sort of swimming through this ever-increasing pink cloud towards presumably where this seal was.
Not knowing if it was dead.
Well, I presumed it was dead by now. Anyway, there was this increasing pink cloud of in the water, and all the amphipods, thousands of amphipods, were already heading towards this thing within minutes. It was incredible, because, I mean, they will actually reduce, you know, a seal corpse to literally bones within a few days. It's quite amazing. Anyway, so I was swimming through this cloud with a stick, and I eventually came across this leopard seal on the bottom and sort of poked it gingerly just to see if it was going to spring into life. But the amazing thing was that this big animal, and it was a very big female, it was about, I think, 12 or 14 foot long, underwater you could pick it up with one hand and sort of almost, and you know, sort of throw it, and it would sort of glide off, you know, into the distance. I mean, it was just sort of amazingly streamlined. Anyway, that was a leopard seal that didn't last very long. Within minutes, Dick Laws, who was then head of life sciences, and of course Dick's an ex whaling inspector, you know, in fact, anything very large on the mammal scene Dick was interested in. Mm. I've never seen somebody become so animated so rapidly as Dick, clutching a huge great flensing knife, suddenly started working on this leopard seal. They actually have, I think I've eaten a variety of seals, but leopard seal's quite amazing because a leopard seal steak is almost like a coal, you know, coal black. Well, it's like a piece of coal. It's black as a piece of coal. It's absolutely, the myoglobin in those animals and in their muscles is, it makes the meat absolutely black. It's quite incredible.
And tasty?
Not as good as leopard. Not as good as young elephant seal. Let's put it that way.
There's some debate, I think, isn't there, about, well, there has been. I remember talking to Dave Fletcher last week about whether leopard seals are naturally aggressive or naturally inquisitive.
I don't think they are. I think they're naturally inquisitive, and they are a big predator. And I think, but it's exactly the same situation as I think you'd get with a terrestrial predator. They're fearless because they don't actually have anything preying on them. Well, leopard seals could have killer whales. But on the whole, it's the same sort of curiosity as I suspect you'd get from a big cat. You know, they are not frightened of what's around them, and they will come up. But of course, they're also testing the situation. So a diver blowing bubbles is an interesting experience for them. But I don't know what the dividing line is between their interest in you as to whether they're just simply interested in you or whether they suddenly see you as a potential meal. Mm-hmm. We had another interesting experience with leopard seals because we used to have this sort of stupid competition in Sydney. Just as the sea ice was freezing, but it wasn't sufficiently frozen to support you wholly, we used to have this thin ice race at Sydney, which was basically to get to the other side of the bay, just the cove. Normally the prize, I think, was a sort of week's supply of chocolate or something. And you could do whatever you like. You know, you could wear great big long planks of wood, or you could do what you like to try and get to the other side of the cove. And Paul Skilling and I had actually got a smaller ice floe, and we were actually using this as a sort of battering ram to go through the new sea ice by using a grappling hook and pulling ourselves forward. The problem was that our ice floe was progressively getting smaller by the minute, so that as we neared the other side of the cove, and we were about 20 yards from the other side, by now we were actually standing on a piece of ice up to our thighs in water. So our ice floe was actually underwater, and suddenly there was this enormous snort from just behind me, and this leopard seal, you know, 4 or 5 feet out of the water, suddenly was literally, you know, right behind me. I think that put the adrenaline level up a bit.
How was that resolved?
Well, luckily they'd seen us from the base, and they were over with a boat very rapidly, because I didn't really want to be in the sea standing on a submerged ice floe with a leopard seal within 3 feet of me.
So was there any health and safety precaution about that? If you're going diving, were there...
No, not really.
There was nobody watching out for leopard seals in the bay?
No. I mean, no. We were cautious about leopard seals, but the numbers of instances we had with them... I mean, most of the leps would be... in the summer would be around the penguin colonies rather than in Bourge Bay itself. So they normally weren't a great problem.
Did you make any discoveries that helped your scientific work?
Well, I think it's like science, you know, sort of moves forward in little sort of little steps. I mean, I think the results I produced were probably as interesting as most people's PhDs at that time. I don't know. I can't think there was anything absolutely startling, but it added to the sum of things, I think.
You were appointed base commander for the second year and the third year, I think, as well. Was that a surprise?
Well, yes, sort of. Yes. I mean, there was 12 of us on base the first winter in Sydney, and I can't remember how many we lost then, but I think there was probably about 8 of us went on into the second winter, I can't remember. Well, yes, it's a bit of a surprise, because I always regard myself as a sort of, you know, I resembled much the same as I had at university, which was to look like a sort of completely semi-wild Jimi Hendrix. And not particularly sort of well-versed in discipline. So, yes, I was surprised. I took over from Jerry Light, who'd been the base commander before me. And you suddenly have to become slightly more responsible on base. Although, you know, quite frankly, activities on base, particularly, you know, physical activities, were run more by common sense than they were by health and safety rules.
Mm. But you were presumably having to give the go-ahead for certain adventurous activities.
Yes, but actually, you'd always judge the person's capability rather than the actual activity. I mean, there were some people on base who were instinctively brilliant at handling boats, who you wouldn't worry about at all. There would be other people who, quite frankly, shouldn't be near a small boat. And it would be the same. I mean, we didn't actually have, unlike when Jerry Light was base commander, and Jerry was an experienced mountaineer, but we didn't have anybody who was wildly enthusiastic about climbing mountains and that sort of thing. So, in fact, you didn't really have to worry too much because, you know, mere amateurs weren't going to put themselves into very difficult situations. I did at one stage have to ban. We were getting more and more, or the guys were getting more and more enthusiastic about winter sports. Mm. But, I mean, winter sports consisted of hurtling down, you know, quite precipitous sort of slopes on tin trays and things. And unfortunately, our cook took off and landed on his face, I think, from about 20 feet up, at which point I think we sort of had to curtail the winter sports a bit. And if I remember rightly, actually, at that time, there was one of the guys broke his leg on South Georgia just from skiing. So it was, and this is pleasure skiing rather than doing anything about work. I think on the whole, activities were, I say, there weren't actually many rules and people just acted with common sense.
This may be a red herring, but were you aware of Jeremy Light's telepathy experiments?
No.
Okay, well, I'll tell you about that later on.
Oh, okay.
All right. Did your base commander duties, did they ever get in the way of the science you were trying to achieve?
Oh, yeah, very much so, actually. And it was interesting. I mean, I don't know whether it was my incompetence or not, but I was the last scientific base commander on Cygni. And I say, you know, I didn't know whether London thought, my God, you know, we can't have any more of these scientists doing this role. I don't think it was like that. I think there was a real realisation that, for example, the last summer on, my last summer on Cygni, we're now talking about, you know, the sort of early 1973. And, I mean, Cygni at that time was a base designed to sleep and house just about 20-odd folk. And because we had the turnover on base and because we had a major building program on base, they were building a new generator shed out the back, the base complement went up to 43. I mean, and people were literally sleeping anywhere and everywhere. And by the time you're running a base of 43 and trying to do a science program yourself, I was spending probably 70 or 80% of my working day actually trying to cope with being a base commander. I mean, you know, floods of telexes coming in from London, sorting out whatever one needs to sort out on base with personnel. So it became a major, you were being pulled in both directions. And it was, I don't mind admitting, actually, it was very stressful. The funny thing was, when I got back to Monk's Wood in about, I don't know, it was April or May 1973, I mean, I wasn't feeling very well. And I think, I didn't know it was my chest, but it actually turned out to be my stomach. Was causing problems. And I went into the hospital in Huntingdon to see a guy about my stomach. And I was from the Antarctic, et cetera, et cetera. He said, oh, that's interesting. He said, I had a guy came in last year, he said, just with exactly the same problems as you. Yeah, what was his name now? Oh, Jerry Light, he said. And so this was obviously a common complaint of ex-base commanders, you know, the sort of. So, yes, I think there was
a tension. Was it
tension? Well, I mean, you know, you're trying to do two things at once. Yeah. And it worked out. I mean, insofar as, you know, I was reasonably successful in doing the science and so was Jerry. But I think it was the right move that they then, after my tenure, brought in, you know, effectively professional base commanders to run the base. So Dave Fletcher came in and whatever it was in March 1973 and took over from me from Halley.
So do you think you had any influence on that decision to...
No, I think it was a no. I didn't have... I mean, I wasn't complaining to London that, you know, I can't do these two jobs. There was no mention of that. I think that somebody somewhere had decided that if you're going to actually have a science complement, you can't be expecting them to do the management as well.
And I suppose, as always with these things, the amount of management that needs to be done increases with time and numbers. And
well, even in those days, you know, it was very considerable because basically virtually every telex going in either direction to Stanley required to pass over the desk of the base commander. And, you know, that and ordering, you know, literally doing all the ordering of stores or, you know, all the things that go on a base. So it's quite an onerous job, even in those days.
Communications 40 years ago were rather more rudimentary than they are today.
Well, yes. I mean, you know, in some ways that's... you get used to it, of course, I mean, because that's what you've got. There wasn't a problem. In fact, in some ways, it was almost advantageous. I begin to think, well, at least we were at the other end of the world and we didn't have to worry about it. You know, we didn't have to worry about what society was doing just, you know, round the corner. But in fact, if you're in almost daily or hourly email contact or phone contact back with the UK, you're remote, but you aren't. And it must be a very different sort of feeling, actually. We were remote and we didn't worry about it. In fact, it became very, very difficult. I mean, we used to almost sit there communally sort of chewing the ends of pencils, trying to work out, well, what do we say this month that we didn't say last month in the... I think we were given 200 words ration to send home a month or something like that. And, of course, it went to both, you know, girlfriends and parents. So, but, I mean, you know, you were racking your brains as to what you could write in November that you didn't write in July.
That's interesting. You're the first person to mention that. Most others complained about the lack of words.
Oh, no, I didn't. I found it very difficult. And there was one occasion, just one. In fact, you see, my ex-girlfriend is just in the room next door.
My wife.
And I remember one day being in the radio shack and Jay, our radio operator, was a complete and utter ham loony. At one stage, he drilled a hole up through the roof of the Tonsberg house, the wooden building on Signy, and he erected this great big V-shaped twizzling aerial to increase his capabilities of ham radioing. And one day I was in the radio shack just by chance and he was actually having a telex sked with a guy in Southwest Africa at that time, Namibia. And the guy in Southwest Africa was having a radio sked with somebody in Devon. And I just happened to say, oh, that's interesting, my girlfriend lives in Devon. So he said, oh, I'll pass a message through. And the guy in Devon obviously phoned Sandy, my girlfriend, now wife, and I had a reply within about a quarter of an hour. That was the only instance I thought of almost like modern day communications. And, you know, we used to have the Goon Show in the evenings where, you know, 10 o'clock every evening we ring up the bash ships and so on. And I say we used to have sometimes mad communications, like we could spend hours playing darts matches with Palmer Station over the air.
Yeah.
They used to think we cheated. And
I guess you didn't.
No, we didn't. Never.
Yeah, I've come across this before. There are two boards, one at each station, and you just throw your own darts and rely upon the...
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, you know, there was one stage where literally we had to finish and it was finishing on a double bull and they just didn't believe us.
I was interested in your working day because if it wasn't for the Goon Show and the need to be up still at 10 o'clock at night, you might have changed your clocks.
Well, we seriously thought about this because... Well, it's rather like in the UK, actually. Often the best weather in the day is probably quite early in the morning. And, I mean, we used to get up reasonably early and start work, you know, almost like a sort of day in the UK. But we seriously, as a base, we sat down as a community and we were contemplating moving our clocks. So we'd actually just literally change all the clocks and move them back to, you know, so we'd all get up at 5 o'clock in the morning. And if it hadn't been for the poor old radio operator who would still have had to sit there at 10 o'clock at night, which by now would be about 1 o'clock in the morning. I think we all would have actually moved the clocks deliberately. And of course, after about day one, it wouldn't have mattered two hoots. You know, we got up at 5 o'clock, we'd think it was 8 o'clock.
Were you aware of protecting the environment of the Antarctic at that point in your life? I mean, I know later on you were deeply involved.
I mean, I was a biologist, and therefore you're interested in the environment, both the living environment and you know, the environment landscape generally. But, you know, we were very cavalier. And in some situations, actually, being cavalier didn't probably biologically matter that much. But, I mean, you know, every spring when the penguins are laying, you wait until they've just laid their second egg, which is pretty synchronised, and then you go and nick it. So we were collecting probably about 1,500 penguin eggs, chinstraps or adelies, every year. And that was our egg supply. So we put them in boxes of flour, and they were just by the back door of the base, by opposite the toilet and the Elsan. And particularly in winter, and these boxes of flour had thermometers sticking out of them. And when anybody went to the toilet, they were supposed to check the thermometers and see what they were doing, and either open or close the back door to maintain the temperature of our eggs. And every week we turned these boxes of flour containing eggs over. I mean, they were pretty inedible insofar as having them as fried eggs, but they were passable if you made them into omelettes and put a lot of mixed herbs in them. But that was just one instance. I mean, we also were very energetically trying to fill up. There's a little cove over the back of the base at Cygni, aptly named Gash Cove. And we were very energetically trying to fill up that cove with empty beer bottles and tin cans. I mean, that is where your rubbish went, basically into the environment. And so, you know, many of these things weren't exactly what you'd call environmentally friendly. And it was a bit of a irony, actually, you know, 20 years later, is to suddenly find you're actually in the midst of negotiating very tough rules which would completely change how we think of environmental measures in Antarctica.
You were also feeding the wildlife, weren't you, at some time?
Oh, well, yeah, I mean, you know, we fed the wildlife either deliberately or inadvertently. We had a little, of course, the waste pipe from Cygni, and this is another thing, you know, things like sewage treatment plants, forget about it, you know, basically it went straight out from the base into the sea. Mm. And the waste plant, the waste pipe that came out of the kitchen at Cygni, I always remember, because it was one of the sheath bills. We used to call him Waste Pipe Willie, and he was slightly smaller than the other sheath bills. And so he could run up the pipe and, you know, get the best pickings of whatever was coming down from the kitchen before the other ones. Of course, this was a self sort of monitoring mechanism that if he got too fat, he wouldn't get up the pipe. But the other thing was, I mean, we thought nothing about, you know, literally, there was a bird table out the back of the, just out the back of the kitchen in Cygni. There was actually a bird table there where we used to feed the mutts. And in our second winter, where we were reduced to eating tin chickens. The first winter, we'd had wonderful supply of frozen food because we had a big deep freeze, I mean, a big deep freeze building. So we had best Argentine steaks, upland geese, reindeer from South Georgia, you know, you can hardly call it lamb from the Falkland Islands. The second winter, all that went because the deep freeze was converted into a constant temperature room for the invertebrate biologists. So we were down to tin chickens. And it is quite a remarkable feat of watching a great skua. It's rather like one of those egg-eating snakes. I don't know if you've seen the pictures of an egg-eating snake where they can completely dislocate their jaws to eat an egg. Well, if you watch a great skua eat a tin chicken, it's about the same. It's quite remarkable. But, of course, by today's standards, it's completely unacceptable. So,
well, did you have any inkling of that?
No, none at all. I mean, nowadays, particularly on chicken and poultry products, that was one of the things that has been banned very strictly from the Antarctic in terms of, you know, poultry should not come into contact with, you know, native birds species, at all because of disease problems. But we had no inkling. No, I mean, I say, I don't think we were deliberately cavalier. You were simply working under the rules. Well, they weren't rules, but you're working under the practices of the time, which you didn't think anything of.
But, and there weren't any repercussions, really, in the end.
No.
The environmental issue protection plan came in later.
No, I mean, you know, we had bloody great bonfires. We threw tin cans into a cove, and actually they would come out of the cove and sometimes liberally redisperse all over Bourge Bay. But actually, probably, at the end of the day, the environmental impacts, the environmental footprint was probably very, very small. But then you see, even on, I mean, a base like Cygni with a very small complement, I think has a very small environmental footprint. That said, I think it's a very good thing. You see now with the bigger bases, strict controls on environment. I mean, I've been around, I think, virtually every base on the Antarctic Peninsula in terms of actually formally carrying out inspections under the Antarctic Treaty. And inspections nowadays are mainly environmental inspections. And, you know, you can see the efforts that everybody's trying to put in to clean up their act and on the whole, doing very well.
But the counter-argument has always been that there's such a tiny, tiny, tiny pinpoint of human activity in the Antarctic that actually, in the end, it doesn't make that much difference.
Well, you're probably right. But, I mean, one's striving to clean up your mess and your impacts. But if you put them in context, you're probably absolutely correct. I mean, you know, there's been a lot of talk in the Antarctic Treaty of trying to, say, reduce diesel combustion. But if you looked at all the bases in the Antarctic that are burning diesel in relatively small generators, they will have a local effect, certainly just around the base, and it's probably a very localized effect. But if you looked at the atmospheric effluent overall, it's peanuts compared with, for example, one tourist vessel. I remember looking at a tourist ship, it was actually in Seattle, and saying to the guy, one of the managers of the tour operator, saying, presumably this thing's got the power generation of a small town. And he said, incorrect. This thing has the power generation of a medium-sized town. And so, you know, if you've got large tourist ships operating on the Antarctic Peninsula, those ships alone are probably putting out far more in terms of polluting effluent, aerial effluent, than all the bases put together. So, you know, yes, you can put it in a sort of scale like that.
One thing that is a constant worry, though, even now, is the spread of disease in the Antarctic. So I can see that whilst physical pollution is quite contained, disease, of course, could get anywhere, couldn't it?
That's true. I mean, there were concerns. Well, when we were negotiating the environmental protocol, there were actually major concerns about, distemper from dogs actually affecting seal populations. I mean, it is a problem. And I think biosecurity has become more of an issue. It's probably not as tough as it ought to be, actually. I mean, luckily, to some extent, the sheer environment of Antarctica mitigates against quite a lot of invasive species insofar as they can't survive, whether they're pathogens or introduced species. But it is a problem, yes. I mean, just going back to this whole business about environmental standards, I mean, I think, you know, as I say, it was a bit of an irony, really, to be exposed to what we were doing in the 1970s and then sitting around a table in the 1990s negotiating what actually were going to be very tough, rigorous rules for how to deal with environmental issues in the Antarctic. And it was quite, I always remember. And then, of course, I think there was even the older school, which was pre-us in the 1970s. And an example of that was, it was quite funny at times, because the first negotiations of the Environmental Protocol to the Antarctic Treaty actually took place in Viña del Mar in Chile in late 1990, about, I think it was October. Anyway, we'd be sitting there discussing various things, and there was at least two occasions when we thought we'd just clinched it. You know, we'd just managed to get the Russians to agree to phase out open burning in the Antarctic. When the distinguished delegate from SCAR at the other end of the table would suddenly put up his hand. Now, the distinguished delegate from SCAR at that time was, who looked like Rasputin, was Nigel Bonner, ex-head of life sciences of Bass. And Nigel would suddenly, you know, stick his hand up and say, "I don't know what all the fuss is about." He said, "A bloody good bonfire and a few sort of, you know, parties, drink a few beers, no problem at all," you see. And you sort of roll your eyes and think, "Thank you, Nigel. We've just spent 2 days trying to agree that point." Or, you know, a couple of days later, and we managed to persuade the Italians that were, you know, that, or the Italians were talking about, right? The Italians were saying, "Why don't we ban all firearms?" Up goes the hand of the distinguished delegate from SCAR, who explains to the Italians that firearms are necessary as a major sampling tool for certain forms of wildlife. And then he ends off this intervention, which is typical Nigel, you know, basically if it moved, let's shoot it. He ended this intervention and saying by, "And anyway, they would be the solution to the dog problem." And there's a sort of stunned silence in this international meeting. So, you know, I say it's all about different standards over different generations of people who have been exposed to the Antarctic.
Where did you stand on the withdrawal of dogs from the continent?
Well, I was in a difficult position, and this is a situation, and since this is a historical archive to a degree, mm-hmm. I was in a very difficult position. Most countries, and it just goes back to the comment you were making a few minutes ago about things like introduced disease, most countries, most states sitting there in the room wanted actually the removal of dogs. There were only three parties still running dogs in the Antarctic: ourselves, the Australians, and the Argentines. And we were under enormous pressure from, for example, the US to get rid of the dogs. We were all rather reluctant to do so. But I say people were throwing all sorts of arguments at us. Now, before I went to this particular Antarctic meeting, I discussed the matter with the then director of Bass, who basically said, "Well, off the record, it would suit our purposes if, in fact, they just went." Fine. They did go. At which point, the director Bass, of course, you know, nothing to do with him. So I suspect I was working to a Bass management agenda, which, of course, most of the staff in, well, all of the staff in Bass would not be aware of and would have not supported, because I knew that there was actually a very considerable backlash. And, you know, I mean, the last dogs were at Rother at that time, and I know people were very genuinely upset when the dogs went. And at the end of the day, it goes back to, you know, the footprint. Okay, there is always a problem about disease, but you can minimise that by biosecurity. But, you know, you could easily argue, well, what is more environmentally friendly? A team of dogs? There is also the problem, of course, we were killing a lot of wildlife to sustain the dogs. So, I mean, you know, an awful lot of elephant seals or Weddell seals got knocked on the head to feed the dogs, say, at Stonington. But, you know, in terms of, is it more environmentally friendly to fly helicopters around or skidoos than dogs? I mean, there was actually quite a funny twist to the dog issue, because at that time, I'd by now joined the Foreign Office, right? And I had Sir Ranulph Fiennes and Mike Stroud were doing their Antarctic crossing. We had not been totally happy about Sir Ranulph Fiennes' crossing, but because we were never very happy about unsupported NGO activities. But since the Prince of Wales was the patron of Sir Ranulph, And the last thing the Foreign Office wants is a nasty little note from the Foreign Office to the Foreign Secretary saying, why are you being so beastly to my dear friend Sir Ranulph? He went. Then I got a request from Sir Ranulph Fiennes that they wanted to use the laboratories. When they arrived at McMurdo, he and Mike Stroud wanted to use the laboratories at McMurdo to do physiological checks. However, the Americans had exactly the same view as us about non-governmental activities. In other words, if they were not sponsored by a government, the US would not provide any support whatsoever to NGO activities. So Tucker Scully and the State Department basically said no. So I said, look, Tucker, we've actually got, we've both got a problem. I've got Sir Ranulph Fiennes who wants physiological laboratory space, and you've got this guy, Vaughan. Now I can't remember his other name, but he'd been the first dog sledge guy with Bird, and he wanted to go back to the Antarctic to visit Mount Vaughan or whatever it was, and he needed some dogs. And the guy, it was the senator for Alaska, I think, was causing all sorts of problems in the US government, demanding why the government wasn't supporting dear old Vaughan. So I got on to Tucker Scully, said, look, if you can give me some laboratory space at McMurdo, I can get you some dogs for Vaughan, as long as he then takes them out of Antarctica and makes sure he disposes of them, I mean, you know, deals with them correctly. And even then, the Americans wouldn't play ball. So we couldn't give the Rothera dogs to Vaughan, and Sir Ranulph Fiennes didn't get his laboratory space. And what actually did happen was that Vaughan picked up some dogs in Chile, flew to Antarctica. There was a problem on the plane, as far as I remember. I think they were carrying a skidoo or something like that with petrol in it, and petrol fumes filled the plane, at which point they turned the electricity off, you know, the electrics off. I think the windscreens all froze up. They crash-landed. Well, they crashed when they landed. Half the dogs escaped, never to be seen again. So that so that was a little story probably that never hit the press either.
That's new on me, absolutely. So, disposing of the Rothera dogs was a tricky problem too, because the eyes of the world's press were upon Rothera, and so they couldn't really be just taken out and shot, could they?
No, I mean, I think it was a tragedy at the end, because, I mean, of course, that was the fate of virtually all Bass dogs, because they didn't tend to come back to the UK, because if they did, they probably killed and ate most of the dogs in the street. So, I mean, most dogs, and a lot of Bass dogs were, you know, they tended to be suffering from, as far as I remember, the Stonington dogs, they did have problems with entropium, ingrowing eyelids or something like that, and arthritis. Mm. And most sledge dogs, as far as I recall, didn't sort of go past 5 or 6 years and would then end up, you know, humanely with a bullet. But of course, you couldn't do that with the last remaining dogs at Rothera. And if I recall, despite all the precautions that were taken in terms of inoculating them against everything, and I think they went back to Canada, and I don't think many of them or any of them outlived another 6 months or something like that. It was
so there were three survivors.
It was not a very satisfactory situation. So, and of course, you know, it was indeed the sort of end of a particular era for Bass.
Let's take a short break, if we may, Mike, and come back and do some more.
Okay.